This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga, and here is what's coming up.
In order to better serve their interests, as soon as they took power in Mali, in Burkina Faso, and in Chad, the military government tried to control the media by means of prohibition or restriction, and even attacks and arbitrary arrests.
That's Adibo Marong, West African Director for Reporters Without Borders, about the impact of military regimes on media freedoms. Also, aid groups seek funds for those hit hard by Cyclone Freddy in Malawi. Experts say the situation in the Central African Republic reveals rampant ethnic violence and systemic violations. And many Christians are marking Holy Week ahead of Easter next Sunday. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Burkina Faso's government has expelled two French journalists following publication of a report about alleged child executions in military barracks. The move is the latest in a crackdown on French media by the West African country's military junta. Anika Hammerschlag reports from Dakar, Senegal.
Libération correspondent Agnès Fèvre and Le Monde reporter Sophie Douce were summoned by Burkina Bay military authorities for questioning Friday and later given 24 hours to leave. The pair arrived in Paris Sunday. Burkina Faso's ruling military junta has given no reason for the expulsions. Reports say there was no comment from the French Foreign Ministry. In a statement, Libération said the junta was angered by its March 27th report about an investigation into a video that showed a soldier killing children and adolescents. According to Libération, social media reports say Burkina Bay officials accused Fèvre and Douce of infiltrating the country and of being paid to create false testimonies. The newspaper said Burkina Faso's restrictions on the freedom to inform are a sign of a power that does not allow its actions to be questioned. The Burkina Bay government also suspended broadcaster France 24 on March 27th and suspended Radio France International in December. Sedi Boumerang is the West Africa director for Reporters Without Borders.
Military juntas have not hesitated to reshape the media landscape in order to better serve their interests. As soon as they took power in Mali, in Burkina Faso, and in Chad, the military government tried to control the media by means of prohibition or restriction, and even attacks and arbitrary arrests.
They've also implemented complex media accreditation processes, Morong added.
This hampers journalistic work and do not respect the principle of journalists being able to protect the identity of their sources.
A report on press freedom by Reporters Without Borders released Monday found five journalists have been killed in the Sahel over the last 10 years and hundreds have been threatened. Recently, two others have gone missing. Security and instability have become worse in West Africa as countries deal with a spreading Islamist militant insurgency. Burkina Faso saw two military coups in 2022. Heads of state in Chad, Guinea, and Mali have also been forcefully removed in recent years. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
Kenya's opposition leader, Raila Odinga, yesterday called off anti-government protests scheduled for today, saying he was ready for negotiations following an appeal from President William Ruto. Kenya's top prosecutor dropped charges against four lawmakers today over anti-government protests, according to their lawyer. VOA's Nairobi correspondent, Mariama Diallo, tells me that the city was calm and that people expect the two principals to reach some compromise.
I think everyone, it's safe to say, that is breathing a sigh of relief. I think you can tell from the attitudes. When I look at people today, they felt relaxed, somehow relieved that there is at least a temporary truce. I think coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic and the impact that basically the Ukrainian war has been having on many countries' economies, I think people seem to not want to see another prolonged demonstrations because, as Ruto said yesterday, the two-week, three-day protests have cost Kenya not only its image, but the widespread violence, the looting, the invasion of private property, he said yesterday, had seriously affected everyone, especially businesses. But on the other hand, the opposition has also had accused the government and the police for use of excessive force. I think last week, Odinga, during a press conference, actually claimed that his convoy was attacked and his car was hit with seven live bullets, each of them aimed at him. I watched basically when he explained that to reporters that basically aimed at him when him and his supporters were exercising, all they were doing was basically exercising their democratic rights. I think the fact that President Ruto extended an olive branch and also making some concessions, including the suggestion of that bipartisan engagement in parliament regarding the reconstitution of the IEBC panel, I think it was a positive development, as Odinga said yesterday. And because of that, that's a reason why, at least one of the reasons, that he called off today's protest.
One of Mr. Odinga's demands was that those who are arrested and charged for this protest be the charges be dropped. And that has happened today. That must be a good sign about what we can see in the future.
Yes, there are reports that the director of public prosecution has dropped criminal charges against 4 to 6, I believe, lawmakers affiliated with the Azimio Coalition Party, which is Odinga. They had been charged of taking part in this, what they deemed were basically unauthorized demos. I think the prosecution said that the move is to create an environment for peace and dialogue, which was obviously initiated yesterday by the Kenyan president and the opposition leader, Raila Odinga. There are also reports from what I'm seeing that the DPP is set to maybe withdraw other cases. I believe they're talking about 200 cases against protesters arrested during the anti-government demos. I guess we'll update you on that when we get more information.
What do we know about the pending meeting between the two parties?
I don't have a lot of information on that, but I guess a lot can happen within the week. But I would also say I believe a week deadline is short. As we know, yesterday Odinga had said that if he doesn't see meaningful engagement from President Ruto, he reserves the right to get out, him and his supporters, to protest again next Monday. So we will have to wait and see. Hopefully this bipartisan group that was proposed will make some progress. I also didn't hear much about what the president was going to do about the high cost of living during his speech yesterday, which was one of the main reasons the opposition said it was for them for organizing the protest. So if a lot happened over the weekend, I hope as much or more can happen within this week, and we might not see another protest for a while. It's hard to say what would happen, obviously. We're just watching everything closely, and hopefully the dialogue that started will continue.
That was VOA's Nairobi correspondent, Mariama Diallo. She spoke with me from Nairobi. A UN review by independent experts of the human rights situation in the Central African Republic reveals rampant ethnic violence and systemic violations. The report says children are suffering appalling abuse and brutality. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
In kicking off the debate on the Central African Republic, United Nations Rights Chief Volker Turk said he had rarely seen a country with such a dangerously poor human rights record so forgotten by the rest of the world. He said people of the Central African Republic endure violence every day. He said they must live with the fear of being arrested, tortured, and otherwise abused by armed groups, security forces, and private military and security companies. Turk said children, particularly girls, are subjected to horrific acts of sexual violence linked to the conflict. He spoke through an interpreter.
Last year, the Human Rights Division recorded 647 children who were victims of child rights violations, the majority concerning the use of children in the armed conflict, attacks on their physical integrity, their freedom, arbitrary detention, and sexual violence linked to the conflict.
Turk spoke at a high-level dialogue to assess developments in the CAR at the UN Human Rights Council Friday. The CAR has been wracked by sectarian violence for a decade. The High Commissioner urged the CAR government to adopt measures to prevent serious violations from occurring and to provide comprehensive care for the child victims. Virginia Gamba is the special representative of the UN Secretary General for Children and Armed Conflict. She noted the CAR government last year adopted a plan against trafficking and was pursuing other measures to better children's lives. She said more needed to be done.
The recruitment and use of children remained the most prevalent violation verified in 2022. While boys were most affected, girls were also recruited and used by parties to conflict, and most of them were subjected to sexual violence during their association. Some of the girls became pregnant following the rape.
She said children were driven to join armed groups because of poverty and to protect their communities from attacks by rival armed groups. Arnaud Djoubaï Abazene is the CAR Minister of State in charge of justice, human rights, and good governance. He told the UN Council the government is paying attention to all children's issues at the highest level. He said the government is resolved to protect children from being recruited by armed groups, and those guilty of crimes would be prosecuted. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. During U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris's trip to Africa last week, Human Rights Watch informed the White House that the Tanzanian government had cut off health services in Ngorongoro district as part of a voluntary resettlement plan in order to preserve wildlife in the Ngorongoro conservation area. Human Rights Watch asked Harris to bring up the topic during talks with Tanzanian leaders. The International Human Rights Group's Deputy Washington Director, Nicole Weldersham, tells VOA's Caravan Dam the move has hurt the Maasai community's ability to access health services in the area.
The Maasai are a semi-nomadic pastoral community. They've lived in that and managed living amongst vital and endangered wildlife for over 200 years in the Ngorongoro Crater and District. This is not a voluntary resettlement plan for these residents. They are being denied right to health and access to basic services and thus being forced out of their home area. They're being forced to an area that's 600 kilometers away from where they have lived for over 200 years.
Well, the government said this was done in the name of conservation, but HRW has questioned that reasoning. Vice President Kamala Harris bring up the plight of these residents during her talks, do you know, with the leaders in Tanzania?
We aren't sure if she did. We hoped she would. We made a public call after our research was done on the situation there and what's being done to the Maasai community in Tanzania. We made a specific public call asking for Vice President Harris to center human rights and issues specifically like this in the U.S.-Tanzania relationship and in her meetings. We specifically urged her to urge the Tanzanian officials to end the abusive policies in the Ngorongoro district and to preserve the Maasai community's right to health. We think it can be done while also pursuing a pro-climate and pro-conservationist agenda. This community has lived amongst this environment for years, over 200 years, and has even participated in helping protect the environment.
Just give me your assessment overall of Vice President Harris's trip to Africa. Do you think it was a successful one?
So time will tell. The Biden administration has made a full court press this year after their Africa Leaders Summit in December of last year, promising high-level visits, which they are delivering on. I saw a colleague of mine talk about pageantry over policy. So while this catches the headlines, and it's really good to see Africa and different African communities and cultures spotlighted in her visit and other senior U.S. high-level officials' visits, we got to see the impact that this makes on policy. And this particular issue right now in Tanzania is a perfect example for us to watch. Did they raise it? The U.S. is a key development and healthcare partner of Tanzania. They have the leverage with the Tanzanian government to put human rights and right to health, of which many U.S. dollars have gone to fund healthcare and development issues in the country. They are in the right place to have a serious conversation with the Tanzanian government and get some better behavior for the Maasai community. So, you know, applaud their efforts to bring high-level U.S. government officials to the continent this year want to see it make an impact on policy and human rights.
That's Nicole Wildersham, Deputy Washington Director for Human Rights Watch, speaking with my colleague Caro Van Dam. In Southern Africa, a decades-old debate has once again started in the Parliament of Lesotho, the question of the Tiny Mountain Kingdom reclaiming land from its powerful neighbor, South Africa. Lesotho, with a population of 2 million, is surrounded by South Africa, population 60 million. More than twice as many Basotho people live and work in South Africa than in Lesotho, which is considered the Basotho homeland. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
A Lesotho opposition party MP started the old ball rolling again last week. He put forward a motion to declare the whole of South Africa's Free State province, plus parts of four more regions, as Lesotho territory. The South African government immediately declared it would protect its territorial integrity. History records that the land belonged to the Basotho nation before Dutch settlers seized it in the 1800s. Basotho King Moshoeshoe appealed to British authorities to intervene to prevent the loss of more territory. In 1867, the borders of current-day Lesotho were set in a treaty signed by Britain and the Netherlands. Britain ran the country until independence in 1966. Africa analyst Isaac Komo says Prime Minister Sam Matakane's administration in Maseru has a strong moral and historical claim to parts of South Africa, but is unlikely to pick a fight with a country on which its economy depends.
An option whereby the South African nation can actually give the land to Lesotho, that is very tough. It will create problems.
But, says Komo, there's another option.
Within Lesotho, there have been talks for a long time, saying that Lesotho is not a viable state as it is, and not a viable nation state, that Lesotho should actually join South Africa. The people of Lesotho is in dire straits. That country cannot actually support the people. I've been to Lesotho. It's harsh. And there's not much work. There's not much agricultural land. That's why we find Basotho's rushing to South Africa. And they're doing menial jobs, and they are very, very marginalized. They've got no work, and some of them have actually been to school, and they're very well educated.
Mpu Lepapang of the Free Basotho Movement is campaigning for Lesotho to be integrated into South Africa.
There is no border between Lesotho and South Africa. We have an existence of a river. If there is no rain, there is no border. So Basotho are not outside South Africa. All Basotho are in South Africa.
His position is that Lesotho's sovereignty isn't feasible and never has been.
Why should Lesotho be an independent state within another country, of which we can see that Lesotho is having a lot of problems which it cannot solve? They are caused or imposed by the geographical location of Lesotho within the Republic, because there is no economic transaction that can happen without Lesotho being in South Africa.
Lepapang recalls King Moshoeshoe's fight to restore what he calls the territorial legacy of the Basotho nation.
Actually, the royal family is supposed to be the one which is leading us, because we are saying to our king, our honorable king, that why are you keeping quiet when your people are divided by the river? Why is he not running ahead of us to try and bring all the Basotho under the same kingship?
Lesotho doesn't have much by way of minerals and resources, but as Komo points out, its mountains and rivers ensure its dams are always full. In 1986, Lesotho signed a deal with the apartheid government to supply largely arid South Africa with water in exchange for royalty payments. This deal holds, and according to Pretoria, it paid Lesotho almost $80 million for water in 2022. Should Lesotho push for integration into South Africa, says Komo, the water card would be a strong one to play. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump will be in New York City tomorrow to be arraigned after a grand jury indicted him on criminal charges. The indictment of a former president is unprecedented in U.S. history. The exact charges are not yet known as the indictment remained sealed. The former president denies the allegations and says political enemies are persecuting him. VOA New York City correspondent Tina Trin is at the courthouse today in Manhattan, New York. She spoke earlier with my colleague Kat Pound Dawson.
Right now in downtown Manhattan, outside of the Manhattan DA's office, we're seeing a lot of the same stuff that we've seen throughout the past week and a half or so, meaning a large police presence on the ground, a lot of blocked streets, a lot of metal barricade that kind of reroute pedestrian traffic around the scene. So more than anything else, just a huge media presence. All the major outlets are out in full force and ready to just get any additional information and ready to pounce when they can on potentially the next Trump sighting. He has been away from New York for a little while now, and to come back in this fashion is definitely a unique turn in his story. He is definitely a New York boy who grew up in Queens and came to make it big in Manhattan.
What is known about the schedule for his arraignment and court appearance tomorrow? Has there been a timeline published by the district attorney's office?
So reports are saying that he will be arriving midday sometime tomorrow. And he will be booked, fingerprinted, and photographed. And then he will be able to hear the charges formally presented to him and be able to plead guilty or not guilty. And he is planning on traveling to New York today in order to make this arraignment proceedings tomorrow. He will be staying at Trump Tower, at his Trump Tower building in Midtown Manhattan. As far as we know, everything should be pretty straightforward. He is expected to make remarks after the proceedings, and that will actually take place in Florida, reports are saying, at Mar-a-Lago once he returns from New York.
Are there any protests expected tomorrow or even today?
Yes, tomorrow on Tuesday, we expect that the New York Young Republican Club will be holding a protest at noon nearby across from the criminal courts building in Lower Manhattan at a park across the street. So they will be gathering to show support for the former president, and Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene is also expected to attend this rally.
That was VOA correspondent Tina Trin in New York. She spoke with editor Kate Pound Dawson. Many Christians are marking Holy Week ahead of Easter next Sunday. In Rome yesterday, Pope Francis celebrated Palm Sunday at the Vatican, the start of Holy Week for Roman Catholics. Thousands of people waved palm and olive branches as Francis was driven into the Vatican a day after leaving a hospital where he was treated for bronchitis.
Per partecipare alla gloria della risurrezione, egli è Dio.
Speaking in Italian, Pope Francis gives a blessing to the faithful at the Vatican. He says they take part in the glory of the resurrection of God, which is with you in the unity of the Holy Spirit for all the centuries and centuries. Amen. In Nigeria, hundreds of people took part in a Palm Sunday procession in Lagos. Outside the Holy Cross Cathedral, the Reverend Raymond Emedo talks about the procession.
The procession on Palm Sunday is very important in Christendom because it signals for us the beginning of the Holy Week, when we celebrate the death and resurrection of Jesus. On this day, many years ago, Jesus walked the streets of Jerusalem and he was heralded as the King of the Jews. But for us as Christians today, we salute and recognize him not just as King of the Jews, but the King of the whole world, our own King, the one who is the Prince of Peace.
In Jerusalem, thousands of Christians from around the world took part in the annual Palm Sunday procession. Holy Week ends on Easter, when Christians believe Jesus Christ rose from the dead after being executed by the Romans. Orthodox Christians, however, celebrate Easter a week later on April 16th. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, visit our website at voanewsafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbi Yeboro, and our engineer, Alfredo Santos, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.